This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. There's a pizza place that just about every Hoosier has heard of, but it's pretty remarkable considering that many locations don't have any kind of advertising budget. Pizza Kings dot the corners of small communities, and most haven't changed over the years. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier reports, that appears to be the recipe for the Hoosier restaurant's success.
It wasn't long after I moved to Indiana several years ago that I started hearing a lot about the same pizza place. Mention of Pizza King would spark passionate conversations, and it seemed everyone I met had a different favorite location. I wanted to figure out what it is about Pizza King that makes it so beloved in the Hoosier State. Mount Vernon resident Larry Commons was a good person to ask.
I've been coming here my whole life.
He drives to the same Evansville Pizza King at least three times a week for a meal. Here's his theory.
And it's just something that you don't get everywhere, so it makes it special.
Pizza King is an Indiana original. Wendell Swartz and his brother started the first restaurant in Lafayette in 1956. They developed the signature crust, sauce, and toppings the restaurant is still known for today. But here's where it gets confusing.
His brother then, after a year of business, decided that he wanted a different model. So what they did was they divided the state. Wendell took three quarters of the state, and then his brother ended up getting roughly a quarter of it.
That's Edward Bogan, Growth and Logistics Director for Pizza King, Inc. It's one of two Pizza King companies in the state as a result of the split. Wendell's brother took the eastern portion of Indiana and set up a headquarters in Muncie. Many of the associated restaurants use the slogan "Ring the King" because you can call a pizza order in using a phone at your table at some of the locations. That company declined to do an interview for this story. The rest of the restaurants in the state are part of Pizza King, Inc., which Wendell started. Longtime employee Don Schutz bought the business in 1966 and dramatically increased its reach. Now you'll find dozens of restaurants across the state, but no two are quite the same. Bogan says that's because Pizza King isn't a franchise, but has what's called a supply and license agreement.
We can't tell you how to run your business. The only thing you do is you buy core products from us. So then what'll happen is you're still your own boss, all right, and you get to use all the Pizza King memorabilia, the logos, catchphrases, and also the recognition of the Pizza King man. Everybody knows what it is.
Pizza Kings get their crust, tomato paste, cheese, and signature chopped sausage and pepperoni from the corporate commissary every week. But you'll find a lot of variations on how the pizza is prepared, and what you'll find on the menu can vary too. Amore Pizza King in Rockville offers a baked spaghetti special. Owner Park Swain says they've changed the look and feel of the place significantly since buying it in 2011, but the pizza is the same.
Cornmeal is one thing that we do for prep the doughs on. I just don't know that there's many out there doing it.
That familiar taste is what keeps so many people coming back year after year. Some even call wanting pizza shipped across the country. It's the same back down at the Pizza King in Evansville, but Stromboli's are actually king. Co-owner Dan Nix says they account for about 70% of the restaurant's business.
If you started with your grandparents and then your parents had it and then you have it and you go to Pizza King and you're feeding your son and daughter that, it hasn't ran its course.
Nick says they see a lot of regulars, and he estimates they're serving Stromboli's to their fourth generation of customers. He says it's not the special ingredients or the consistency of the food that keeps customers coming back. For many Hoosiers, Pizza King tastes like home. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
On this edition of Building Northwest Indiana, Kevin Comerford talks with Bill Hanna about the Westlake Corridor project on the South Shoreline.
Welcome to this episode of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. My name is Kevin Comerford. I am the Director of Professional Development at the Construction Advancement Foundation of Northwest Indiana, and I will be serving as your host today. The purpose of Building Northwest Indiana Radio is to give you a little insight into the Northwest Indiana professional construction industry. Today we're going to be talking about the Westlake Corridor Project, which is the southern branch extension of the existing South Shore Line that will run from Hammond to Dyer. And we're also going to be talking about the double tracking project, which proposes to expand the South Shore line from a single track to a double track, and that track runs between Gary and Michigan City. This is going to allow the South Shore line to add trains for more frequent service, reduce delays, and improve travel times. So my guest today is going to be Bill Hanna. He is the president and CEO of the Regional Development Authority, also known as the RDA. So welcome to the show, Bill.
Thank you. It's glad to be here.
Just to give our listeners a little insight into what the RDA does and what is your role there, can you provide our listeners with a little more insight into what you do and what is the purpose of the RDA?
Sure, absolutely. The RDA was formed back in 2005 and 6, really, is when it started going. But it was a product of the Indiana General Assembly and then Governor Daniels. And it was a collaborative effort to put together an economic development group that focused on really assets that could be better developed, opportunities up here, and primarily an infrastructure investment. So we originally focused on development of the shoreline, and there's been several projects up there that people are familiar with, like the Whiting Lakefront Park or Gary Marquette or Wolf Lake Park and one in Portage and various others. We have a pretty good-sized project going right now in East Chicago as an example. Gary Airport, South Shore train assets, general economic development. So it really boils down to kind of natural assets for, tourism and people moving in, ground transportation to and from Chicago, and connectivity to the rest of the state and the rest of the world. And those are the things that we focus on. And we're quasi-state, so we work closely with the governor's office and, as I said before, members of the General Assembly in Indianapolis.
So does the RDA only see redevelopment projects in Lake and Porter counties, or are you in LaPorte and St. Joe as well?
Yeah, so we focus on Lake and Porter because those are where our members are, and we have local contributors from different municipalities and the county governments, and those are our partners, and they also have representatives on our board of directors. But since we're working on South Shore projects right now, the train projects, we're working in partnership with LaPorte County and St. Joe County as well. So we'll represent the two counties here in Lake and Porter, but there's a true partnership that's occurring between LaPorte County, St. Joe County, Porter, and Lake, which is, it's a newer thing, and it's been a great advancement to be able to form a four-county partnership in a state where, those four counties constitute quite a large population center, and it gives us a lot of strength in General Assembly to be on the same page and asking for, assistance with projects that we all agree on.
Yeah, it seems like when local communities here in Northwest Indiana, including that four-county area you're talking about, get together, it really benefits the region as a whole. So it's good to see that LaPorte County and St. Joe County are collaborating as well with the RDA. Yeah. Well, speaking about the South Shore line, let's start talking about the Westlake Corridor project. I know that's a project that's coming down the pipeline. I'm not sure where we're at as far as funding is concerned. I just went to a presentation the other day that was for contractors, and it sounds like this project's going to be taken off here in the next year or two. Can you talk a little bit more about that project and maybe talk about a little bit of when that's supposed to get off the ground?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really excited about that one right now. It's been, we've been building these partnerships, and we've had great leadership going on and a lot of support from at CAF and Dewey and Pierman, who leads that group, and trades representatives and others around Northwest Indiana. But it's been a long road, and General Assembly coming together back in, 15 to come up with funds for that project after really, I think, Congressman Visklosky being one, was pushing for this for over a couple decades. And so, when you talk about a year or two away, it's I always feel like I should be reminding people about the scale, because that's almost lightning speed in terms of how these projects go. So we're right there. I expect that we'll be getting an entry into engineering designation, which is it's a term that the FTA uses to say that your funds or your efforts that you're undertaking right now are now reimbursable by the federal government. And here's the important part of that. In every case that I'm aware of where they received an entry into engineering designation, any project around the country like ours, they've always gone forward into a full project mode, with the exception of a couple where the governors of those particular states withdrew the projects on their own. So this is a major milestone, and we actually expect that any time here within the next 3 or 4 weeks. So we're right there. We could break ground in late summer next year. So what I'd like to see personally is some folks working on this project into, you know, the start of or actually the end of next year, what I would call boots on the ground. But, you know, folks from around here breaking ground.
Now, the Westlake Corridor, from what I could tell, is going to be four different stations running from the Hammond Gateway into the existing station that runs out to South Bend. But then it's going to also go down through Munster and through Dyer. And I think the end station is in Dyer. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, it's about 8 miles all told of new track that runs into the, you know, southern portion of Lake County.
And how many stations is it? Is it four stations?
Yes. And so, yeah, and you're correct. The Hammond Gateway Station is really an important one because it that's where the existing South Shore meets the new line of the Westlake. And so what that does for a rider is you could get on in Dyer and you could go all the way to South Bend or Chicago. So you could transfer at that point onto the South Shore train. And so it really makes a north, south, east, west system out of what right now is a single line rail system.
So thank you for sharing everything about the Westlake Corridor project. That'll do it for this edition of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. I would like to thank my guest, Bill Hanna, who is president and CEO of the RDA. And I'm your host, Kevin Comerford. Thanks for joining us today.
Support for Building Northwest Indiana comes from the Construction Advancement Foundation. And you can hear Building Northwest Indiana here on Regionally Speaking, usually Tuesdays, here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And the podcasts for Building Northwest Indiana are available right now online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. Green Fleet Radio is up next. And with Green Fleet Radio today, here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and today our guest is Mr. Andrew Penka. He's the Executive Director of Battery, Supply Chain, and Customer Support for Cummins. Well, Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Carl. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Andrew, tell our listeners a little bit about Cummins and what you do there.
Yeah, Cummins is we're a global power leader in design, manufacture, distribute, and service diesel and natural gas engines, along with the components that you know, get assembled into those engines or sold to other engine manufacturers. So things like filtration, after treatment, turbochargers, fuel systems, air handling systems, et cetera. And then also our electric power generation systems, batteries, and the electrified power systems that we're just rolling out now.
Sure, sure. You know, I think we all keep reading about the great things that Cummins is making moves in the electrified power. So how have you been building that business?
Yeah, we've been building the business both organically and inorganically, you know, through several acquisitions, three acquisitions to be specific within the electrified power space, two on the battery side of things and one on the system side of things, you know, from an inorganic standpoint. And inorganically continuing to invest in our people here, growing the business, investing our, you know, product development, technology development, you know, manufacturing scale, et cetera. So, you know, building the business out from the get-go.
Sure. So what do you see as the biggest issues facing the commercial industries today?
Yeah, I think some of the biggest challenges are, one is certainly going to be the changing regulatory environment from a climate standpoint. I think we're seeing that globally, you know, continued stronger positions being taken around commercial vehicles and their access to particularly urban areas, inner city environments. So I think, you know, those that operate in that space on the on-highway space will have to probably deal with that first. I think there's still some questions on the off-highway side of things as to how much regulatory pressure comes and then subsequent enforcement. And then I think with that just is change, right?
Sure.
I mean, how do you adapt and adjust to those changing requirements and ultimately preferences of your end users, and what does that mean for your, you know, fleets that you have in existence today, and how do you rotate equipment out and diversify it? So I think those are probably some of the biggest challenges facing the commercial transport industry today.
Sure. So what factors are driving the adoption of electrification in commercial markets right now?
Yeah, we look at four main drivers for adoption. First, the cost of technology. Like with any new technology, that cost starts at you know, typically at a very high level and comes down. You can see all kinds of examples that exist in the marketplace today. And then, you know, we shift to the regulatory environment. So I think that is one that certainly is playing a role and a factor in today's adoption. And then in this space in particular, the electrified power space, you'd look at the infrastructure, right? So the infrastructure to charge these vehicles and service the vehicles, et cetera, extend their life. And then finally, the overall total cost of ownership. So again, that not only includes the initial capital investment, capital cost, but the operating expense of the electrified power vehicles, and what does that equation look like relative to what people are powering their equipment with today. So those are the four kind of main drivers we see to adoption, and all those are moving at different rates and paces, but we think those four are the key ones that are driving adoption today and will continue to do so in the future.
Okay. So you're listening to Green Fleet Radio on 89.1 The Lakeshore. Our guest today is Mr. Andrew Penka. He's the Executive Director of Battery Supply, Chain, and Customer Support for Cummins. So, Andrew, what markets might next be electrified?
Yeah, I think we're seeing the early adoption right now. We're seeing largely in transit bus, school bus, some material handling applications.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think as you kind of move a little bit further on in that, we'll see things like urban delivery vehicles, pickup drop-off vehicles, last mile type vehicles, port drayage vehicles, and a lot of these vehicles, which are kind of return to base vehicles,
sure.
I think are those that we're seeing the early adoption. And we kind of think of it, if you kind of in your mind picture a city environment and go to the innermost point of that city and think of the vehicles that run around the street, that's largely where we think the adoption is going to start. And then as you move further out from those cities, perhaps into the suburban areas and a bit more, longer routes that would still get home in a day, those may be next. And then when you get to long haul, multi-day type of trips, that's probably on the outer edge of adoption. So that's kind of how we see the transformation of adoption and those vehicles being electrified both today and those set to transition over the future.
Sure. So I know we just recently had the announcements of the Indiana VW mitigation, and so I know there was a lot of transit and school bus that were awarded. So why do you think some of these are the first markets ripe for electrification?
Yeah, again, I think if you look at their duty cycles,
mm-hmm.
I think there's a couple, duty cycle, and then I think, some of the progressive positions local authorities, governments are taking, wanting to drive this technology through into the, particularly again, into the inner city urban environments, I think. So I think in terms of their duty cycles and use, they lend themselves well
mm-hmm.
To electrification. And I think, the other thing is, the amount of subsidies being rolled out and supporting, the purchase of these vehicles for the different transit authorities and school districts as well is certainly an aid to accelerating that transition, at least, getting some of those vehicles out in the marketplace for the end users to try and obviously for customers to experience as well.
So what are you working on right now that you're most excited about?
Yeah, I think, for us, it's kind of two things. I think one is, that the organization has gone under a tremendous amount of change over the last 24 to, kind of 36 months. Again, as I talked about the activity, both inorganically and organically, we've grown very, very fast, and we've blended a number of different cultures. So I think it's one for us in the electrified power business is really securing our identity, our culture, and kind of how all these entities work together seamlessly and productively. And then I think, second is it's hard to deny the excitement of being part of what hopefully will be the next century for Cummins, the next
Absolutely.
The next edition of technology and diversifying Cummins' overall portfolio that much more and offering more choice and more selection for our customers. And, like I said, hopefully that powers Cummins for the next century ahead.
Sure. As we come to the end of our program, Andrew, can you tell our listeners how they can learn more about these types of activities and organizations and the different great things that Cummins is working on, the initiatives?
Yeah, sure. We can be found at our website there at www.cummins.com/electrification or electrification in the search window. And that should pull up all the relevant material. And then obviously out on the internet, anything that's been made public in terms of our activity and, product launches and acquisitions, that stuff, anything that's in the public domain can be found that way as well.
A lot of exciting things going on, Andrew. And that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Andrew Penka. He's the Executive Director of Battery Supply Chain and Customer Support for Cummins. And I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities and the Northwest Indiana Regional Planning Commission. You can hear Green Fleet Radio on Wednesdays here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. As the school year begins, parents are checking off the things that they need to do, including making sure that their youngsters have the required vaccinations. But some parents are opting out. And last year, that led to the worst measles outbreak that the United States has seen in more than two decades. And now, doctors and nurses are working to get more children vaccinated. Here's Side Effects Public Media's Stephanie Whitesides with more.
So she is going to get three. She'll get the DTaP, IPV combination.
Nurse Tracy Thomas is explaining the vaccine schedule to Jemira Crook at the Jackson County Health Department. Crook has brought her two children in to get their shots before school starts. The girls have been playing quietly, unaware of why they're here. They're among the families trying to beat the state's deadline for immunizations against measles and other diseases. Thomas says the department has seen a rush recently.
There is an October 15th deadline that they should have their vaccinations. Otherwise, they would have to get a religious exemption from their physicians.
Only five states in the U.S. ban non-medical exemptions for vaccines. The rest allow parents to opt out for personal or religious reasons. I ask Crook if she worries about parents who don't vaccinate their kids.
Yeah, I guess so, because then they could cause my kids to get sick, so yeah.
Her five-year-old daughter Chloe has other worries. She's thinking about having to get stuck with a needle, despite all efforts to distract her.
Don't watch me, honey. Scary. One, two, three, done.
Parents who opt out of vaccines are generally basing their fears on a debunked study from 1998 and anecdotes of vaccine injuries, which rarely occur. Thompson says the staff at the health department do their best to let parents know vaccines are safe.
Try to tell them, you know, reassure them that we've given lots of shots, haven't seen any bad things, give them the vaccine information statements.
Dr. Jeff Ripperda is a primary care physician in Jackson County, not far from the health department. He says that people who refuse vaccines are rare, but he sees a lot of people who have concerns.
It's a fairly regular occurrence in my practice, and I presume this is true for most physicians who do primary care or pediatrics, to meet parents who are skittish about vaccinating their kids.
When enough people don't vaccinate, an entire community is put at risk for an epidemic. Dr. L.J. Tan of the Immunization Action Coalition calls it community immunity.
And so what happens when you vaccinate is that you take out a certain percentage of the population from actually being able to get infected. So when one person gets sick and then they contact two people, but if both those people have been vaccinated, the infection stops.
Tan says that with a highly infectious disease like measles, communities need at least a 90% vaccination rate to be protected. But some entire states are below that threshold. Even when the state rates are sufficient, individual schools may not be. And that makes it easier for illnesses to spread to people who can't be vaccinated. They might be undergoing chemotherapy or be on steroids for asthma, or they might be too young for certain vaccines.
We live in a community with standards that we respect and protect the vulnerable in our communities.
Some states, like Illinois, make vaccine data publicly available, allowing parents to see where their school district falls. If school rates are low, Tan says parents can pressure the administration or other parents to try to raise them. Dr. Ripperda handles reluctant families a different way. He's found that facts may not sway people, but stories do. He recalls one patient who, at 29 years old, nearly died from the flu.
He had a complication to the flu, and I actually had him on a ventilator in the ICU, and I called his young wife in. He had two young children at the time. And said, I don't think he's going to make it. If you have any family who wants to come and see him before he passes, I think you need to make that happen right now.
The man survived, but he was hospitalized for almost 2 months and needed extra oxygen for a year and a half. When all else fails, Ripperda stays firm. If parents don't want to vaccinate, they need to find a new doctor.
And if somebody wants to come and see me, but they're not going to permit me to do what I think is the single most beneficial thing that I can do for their kids, then what's the point of having a relationship with me?
Steph Whiteside for Side Effects Public Media.
Here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, we've learned that the Indiana Landmarks has a new online guide that is going to showcase the home styles over 200 years. In fact, if you get the Indiana Preservation magazine from Indiana Landmarks, you get a chance to check out a few of them here, but we'll find out more in particular. Let's talk to Suzanne Stannis. She is the Indiana Landmarks Director of Heritage Education and Information, and thanks for being with us on the show today.
Thank you, Chris.
Tell us first how this online guide got started.
Well, we decided that we wanted to do something that was very visual because we had had an old-style guide that was printed that just had line drawings that was done well before probably even the invention of the Internet. And we decided with this, you know, newfangled technology, we could put a lot of photographs of Indiana examples. And then eventually our goal is to be able to have people submit their own photos, likely through Instagram, and we can continue to build that database.
How do you think it was back in the 1950s or so, or maybe even earlier, when that printed guide was first issued?
Oh no, it wasn't really that early, but okay. It was. I think we started it in the 1980s, and then kind of had various incarnations of it. But the problem was, it only showed line drawings, and in often cases, it only showed one example. And the thing with architectural design is that there are so many variations on each style that it's really hard to show one drawing and say, this is what they should all look like.
I guess this also probably didn't take into place what might be considered, at least back then, even back in the 80s, some of the home styles that went back even before then. Like back during World War II, when you talk about the Lustrun homes and the homes that Sears Roebuck used to have their plans on in the catalog.
Yeah, we really added a lot of styles, including those, as you said, post-World War II. And the other thing that we've done that we feel is different than a lot of existing online and printed style guides is we've tried to include vernacular styles. And those are defined as houses that are, typically built by builders or taken out of pattern books or represent particular regional styles. And they're really what most of us live in. And you'll find that the majority of style guides feature what we call high styles. And those are the things that are architect designed and, quite elaborate. So we try to put a lot more information into those vernacular styles. And for example, when we did that first printed guide, we listed a lot of things as just carpenter builder. As just, that's what these simple styles were. And we've since been able to go back and work with folklorists and come up with specific names for each of those styles based upon the shape of the building. So you get the T plan and the L plan and gable front and that sort of thing. The other improvement that has been made since we did the old printed guide is so much more research has been done on the mid-20th century styles.
Mm-hmm.
For so long, we just, again, lumped all those into contemporary, like we did with Carpenter Builder. And there's been a lot of scholarly research on, again, trying to break those down into subcategories and give those more accurate names.
I understand that you all did a lot, so much research on this that you were able to put into the online guide, a way for anybody that goes onto Indiana Landmarks website and looks this up to find out really a bit of history, a lot of history, actually, maybe I should say. You can learn a lot about how we lived in Indiana by the home designs and how a home was built back then. What were some of the things that you all noted, we'll say, from Victorian-style homes to today?
Yeah, and I think that's what really makes the study of architecture more interesting. We're not just looking at details and what makes something Italianate, but we're looking at why was the style popular when it was. And so that's the sort of thing that we have included with this online guide. And say, for example, looking at, the Victorian era, the Queen Anne houses were really highly decorated on the inside. They would have wall-to-wall carpets. People would often have like animal skins on the floors. They might have all sorts of, just little knickknacks sitting around. And then as people started to understand the germ theory towards the end of the 19th century, they realized that germs are what make people sick. And so we see the craftsman style becoming very popular in the early 20th century, the late 19th century. And people are getting rid of a lot of that heavy interior decoration. And they're even making some built-in furniture. If people have a house from that period, they may have built-in bookcases or a built-in sideboard in the dining room and hardwood floors. And then even sleeping porches, which I find fascinating. They thought that, getting outside, getting fresh air was going to make you healthier. So people would actually sleep outside on these sleeping porches, often even in the cold weather.
Did that kind of lend to the development eventually of screened-in porches?
That's a good question that I honestly I don't know the answer to. I'm sure that it must have at some point because, yeah, those early sleeping porches often would have wooden louvers, and so they weren't necessarily screened. But, yeah, good question. I've got, and that's something we could add to that website. We can, and the beauty of the website is you can change it, that we should look into the history of technology of metal screens.
Also, too, when you were putting together the online guide, did you have an opportunity to, again, as part of history, to compare what some of the architects had looked at, maybe as they grew up, as they were being trained? They may have looked at maybe the Bauhaus designs, especially some of these homes that were where the architects have fashioned furniture that goes along specifically with the type of home.
Yeah, exactly. And you definitely start to see that with the mid-century modern styles. And Frank Lloyd Wright is a perfect example of that. In the houses that he designed for clients, he often designed the furniture. He went so far as to, in a couple of cases, design clothing that he thought the woman of the house should wear. So I don't know that anybody else has gone quite as far as Frank Lloyd Wright, but mm-hmm. we do see architects that are designing furniture that will fit in that style of house. So it may not be that they designed it for a specific house, but this is what they recommend, you know, in that type of house.
Are you finding that having the online guide available by folks that go onto the Indiana Landmarks website goes along very well to people that manage to take the tours? For example, like folks that check out the Century of Progress homes up here in Northwest Indiana, when the homes are up for display to the public, once a year, you have a chance to take a look at these homes, and it kind of goes back to the Logsdale Lestrens tour that's been held. You get a chance to make the comparison with types of homes back in the early 20th century, going all the way up through now.
Right, exactly. I mean, you can go back and look at our website and see why were log houses built when they were and how were they changed. And the Logsdale Lestrens tour is a perfect example because we have a log house on that tour that actually had been covered in siding mm-hmm. and removed. And so the style guide talks about, you know, why were things covered in siding and as well as the history behind the Lestrens. So, you know, you'll likely get that information on the tour, but if you forget or you want to share it with anybody, you can easily go back to our website and check out those sections.
Now, I know we've just kind of mentioned it briefly here about how you can find this online guide. Specifically, how can you find this new online guide to home styles over the last 200 years?
Well, right now, if you just go to our website, IndianaLandmarks.org, you'll find it right on our landing page. We're featuring it right now. After that, we have a tab that's called Resources, where we've got all sorts of information helpful for people that are researching their houses or do-it-yourselfers, and it will be combined into that section. And I might also add, mm-hmm. if somebody's interested in researching their house, because we do get a lot of questions about that, we already have an online historic research guide that's also in that resources section, so people can go there and get tips on how to research their house.
That's great to know. Thank you for mentioning that, to be sure. And thank you, Suzanne, for joining us on the program today to talk about this very interesting online guide that's now available out there on the Indiana Landmarks website.
Well, thanks so much. We hope people will visit the website as well as participate in one of Indiana Landmarks programs.
Suzanne Stannis is the Indiana Landmarks Director of Heritage Education and Information. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It was 5 years ago that a team of greening experts, as they're called, to work with the city of Gary and residents in Gary's Etna neighborhood for the city's very first big repurposing project. Vacant to Vibrant project manager Sandra Albro has put out a book on her experiences working with the Steel City, and she was on Regionally Speaking to talk about them.
I'm based in Cleveland, Ohio, and mm-hmm. this is a problem that we're facing here in Cleveland. We also worked in Buffalo. So a lot of post-industrial cities throughout the Great Lakes region have these problems with vacant lots, and we're trying to figure out what to do with them. So the Etna neighborhood of Gary was interesting because of the vacant land that they had. We received a grant from the Great Lakes Protection Fund to look at different greening strategies that could be useful for small vacant lots that are embedded among houses and residents. specifically, because we were seeing other types of vacant land, like large industrial parcels being looked at, but we weren't seeing these smaller vacant lots being examined, and in some ways those can be harder to use.
I know a lot of cases you hear about the term greenfields, and that's, of course, what an EPA likes to use as a term for ones sites that have a particular amount of contamination to deal with, too, as well as being vacant. So we're not talking necessarily about contaminated sites, but we're talking about sites that have been vacant and then sore in use of the resources that are out there. How did you get involved with this project with the city of Gary? Did you find out it from them? Did you consult with them before things really got started in the Etna neighborhood?
I did. We were hosting a series of regional discussions in around 2009, 2010, amongst professionals from different Great Lakes cities to talk about vacant lots and this overlap between community and environmental concerns that different cities were facing, and specifically how vacant lots could be repurposed in ways that helped address those needs. So the city of Gary was very active in those early discussions, and it quickly became apparent that not only was the city of Gary, you know, they had the demonstrated need, but they also had the capacity and interest to try vacant land strategies that hadn't been fully worked out yet. So they were a great partner from the start.
When you get a project like this started, even if you're at the very beginning of the process, you obviously have to consult with people at City Hall. Who did you end up talking to at first as you got things started? And then, of course, then you have to actually go into the neighborhood, wherever you're working, in this case in the Etna neighborhood, and talk with the residents. Tell us about what cooperation you needed to get from Gary City Hall first and then from the neighbors themselves.
We've been working mostly with Brenda Scott-Henry, who is in the Department of Green Urbanism in the Gary Stormwater District. Mm-hmm. And Brenda has been a wonderful partner for years and was involved in these early discussions amongst the region. Also, someone who had previously worked in the Department of Green Urbanism, Lauren Riga, was a participant in these discussions. So that was our in at the City of Gary. They were looking at issues of stormwater management to prevent combined sewer overflow, and they also had all of these vacant parcels, and this aligned well with needs that we had identified both in Cleveland and Buffalo. Then once we got to the city of Gary, we relied on a lot. The Department of Green Urbanism has some good roots in the Etna neighborhood, and so we worked with the department, we worked with local churches, and then we also talked a lot directly with residents. We went door to door, we held community meetings, we went to other community meetings that they were already holding, and through just a variety of methods to capture, you know, different residents and a variety of feedback, we went through a multi-month planning process with residents, hearing their concerns and their desires for their neighborhood, and then working with designers to try to translate those needs and concerns into plans for these little parcels that could help address those needs and concerns.
I know that the Environmental Resilience Institute, which is based at IU Bloomington, has worked extensively with the city of Gary and with you all, I'm sure, on this. And there are pictures that they happen to have on their Environmental Resilience Institute website that show some of the projects. I guess there are, three in particular, the vacant to vibrant sites that were set up in the Etna neighborhood. What did you all take a look at first when you went into a particular neighborhood after talking with the residents, getting the input from them in that process, to take a look and see what's there and what you all and the people they've come in to do the work can actually do?
As soon as we identified Etna as a focus in Gary, we looked at all of the vacant parcels in Etna, and we, you know, just looked at the different characteristics of those parcels. You know, did they have houses on them? Had they been demolished? What kinds of soils were there? How many people lived around them? And what types of indicators were on the parcels that might tell us about, you know, what residents wanted from them? So, for example, a simple footpath that residents have worn down through a vacant lot could indicate that they would like a formalized path or a trail to help them get from point A to point B. And so the three parcels that we looked at and we ended up focusing on in Etna, one of them is on a prominent corner right as you come into the neighborhood. Etna neighborhood actually predates Gary, and so there's a lot of neighborhood pride around the name of the neighborhood and just announcing to residents or to visitors that they've arrived in Aetna. Mm-hmm. So for this prominent corner lot, we ended up coming up with a design that just was a sign of announcing the name of the neighborhood and a series of rain gardens to capture stormwater runoff and help alleviate that stormwater or the combined sewer overflow.
In some of these sites that you all took a look at and you decided to use, to choose to use in the project, were there any houses abandoned or otherwise that were on the sites that you had to take care of first?
Yeah, because of our close relationship with the city of Gary, we were able to do something special in Gary that we couldn't do in Cleveland and Buffalo, and that was to work with the city prior to demolition. So two of the parcels that we worked on had houses. One of the houses had been vacant for 15 to 20 years, long enough that people in the community didn't remember who used to live there. And then another house had been burned out and was there for about 5 or 6 years. City was able to get federal funding to help demolish those houses, but we started working with them before the houses even came down. One of the cool things about that process is that behind one of the burnt out house, there was a really nice cinder block decorative wall and a little walled garden in the backyard. We were able to preserve that wall because we worked with the city prior to demolition, and we turned that into a walled garden that makes a nice picnic space or a good community gathering place.
Besides vacant to vibrant, the Aetna neighborhood was also Gary's first area to provide some materials that were taken from abandoned houses and repurposed by Steel City Salvage. And that project was created by a Chicago-based company, Delta Institute. Charlie Harrison is a UCLA jazz professor and a former associate director of the Jazz Orchestra in Chicago, and the Chicago group is one of the top performing groups in the world. He came down to Northwest Indiana earlier this week and spent a day with Merrillville High School orchestra teacher Diane Rosenthal and her students. Rosenthal commissioned a piece from Harrison specifically for the After School Jazz Orchestra Club for its 2020 Indiana State School Music Association performances. And she talked with us about how she knows Charlie, about his career in music, and the thoughts behind what is called the Pirate Suite.
Well, the way this came about, Charlie and I went to high school together and were musicians together in high school, and reconnected at a high school reunion a couple years back, and you do the usual high school reunion thing. Oh, what are you doing? You married? You got kids? What's your job? Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, and I said, oh, I teach high school orchestra. And he said, I'm a jazz composition professor at UCLA. Okay, so we started chatting, and I had just that year started a jazz club here. I'm a classically trained musician, and so I was a little out of my element, and I thought, well, here's a great resource. So we started chatting, and after about a year or so, I got to the point of saying, hey, do you do commissions? He's a composer, arranger. Would you be willing to write a piece for my jazz club? It's difficult to find music, jazz music written specifically for string instruments, violin, viola, cello, bass. And so he was gracious enough to do that, and we communicated over the next, I would say, 6 months or so getting that done. And then he's been fantastic. He's been in each of my classes all day long. Kids have been asking great questions, and he's been giving them some feedback on their playing.
Tell us a little bit about the piece, and I'll ask him in more detail, too, about the piece that you had him commissioned to do.
The Jazz Orchestra participates in the Indiana State School Music Association Jazz Contest in March, and the requirements of the contest are that the set you play, the pieces you choose to play for the judges, have to show a variety of styles. I can't go and have the kids play all Duke Ellington swing. They have to show that they have flexibility, that they can play ballads, that they can play Latin jazz or any different option, but you can't go in playing all the same.
Yep.
So Charlie and I started talking about the idea of a suite that would take care of that right off the bat. Instead of me trying to find a swing piece and a blues piece, and you know he would take care of that for us. The Pirate Suite then covers the first movement is swing, the second movement is a ballad, and the third movement is blues. And he did communicate with me about the kids' ability level and range and what they'd like to play, what they need to play to learn. And he wrote something that's tailor-made for them. That's an unusual thing.
Now, have they had a chance to do any rehearsals on this piece yet, or will they be learning that in time?
Just a little. I wish we'd been able to do more, but his event that he was coming to Chicago for was in September, and as you know, we've only been in school about 6 weeks, and we have a concert in 2 weeks of all different music, classical music, that we need to be working on. So we've had only two meetings of the jazz club itself after school, last Monday and the previous Monday. We did a little bit of work on it in my most advanced class. some of those kids overlap into jazz. So I'd have at least a few ringers who had had a fair amount of instruction. But Charlie's been very gracious. He understands these are high school kids. We haven't had a huge amount of time on the pieces, but they generally know them, can play them. And I'm hoping that he's going to give them a lot more of the jazz vocabulary and the feel for it that as a classical musician I don't maybe have instinctively to give to them.
Before we bring you our conversation, let's hear a little of Charlie Harrison's work as the conductor of the UCLA Jazz Orchestra. And then he'll tell us more about being with the Maryville High School Jazz Club members and about the special music that he's created for them.
Exciting to see so many really high quality high school jazz programs around and really to expand on that. Working with the Maryville High School Jazz Club, basically being a jazz string orchestra, is really, to me, eye-opening and exciting to see that jazz is now moving beyond just the, I guess, the limitations or the confines that we have put on it previously, meaning mm-hmm. that it had to be either a small combo or just a traditional big band. For me, working on the project and then seeing the kids being so excited about playing jazz as string players is really thrilling for me.
This yeah. Pirate Suite, as it's called, gives the students an opportunity to get the experience within the training that they have with it being a string jazz orchestra of putting together, I guess, an opportunity to learn something that maybe a big band would normally get to do. Did you kind of take some of the ideas from what, for example, Duke Ellington had done with his own suites that he had composed for his band in the past?
Perhaps. I guess we could look at it that way. I don't really say that I was approaching, say, Duke Ellington or Billy Strayhorn would have in their extended suites. I know that they later in Duke Ellington's career, he composed quite a few. And those usually a common inspiration, whether it was one of his suites was the New Orleans suite, and he had written a Latin American suite and a Far East suite, and those usually had some kind of common experience that then led to the inspiration for the music. In this case, or at least in the case of the Pirate Suite, I was really, I think, more motivated by the fact that I was writing for an ensemble that was not the traditional jazz ensemble.
Right.
This is a string group. And by the token that it's a string group, most of the musicians are not seasoned jazz musicians. So what I wanted to do was kind of provide a variety of styles that would expose them to, in some ways, to traditional jazz forms and traditional jazz stylings, but also, in the case of one of the movements, kind of give them a taste of a little bit more modern, at least a more modern harmonic approach, and maybe even a little bit more of a modern approach in, I guess, in terms of the form of the piece. Now, mm-hmm. Two of the movements, the first movement and the last movement, are the ones that I consider to be a little more traditional, and the second movement is the one that's, I think, a little different.
Do you think that the students are really going to enjoy working on this piece, perfecting it and learning it and actually getting to perform it?
I sure hope so. I've enjoyed working with the students, really. Now, we haven't truly worked on the Pirate Suite yet, but I've met quite a few of the students who will be playing in that ensemble, and
mm-hmm.
they seem to be pretty excited about it so far. They've asked me a lot of questions about it, and I'm really thrilled to be here and have a chance to work with them.
This, by the way, is the third year for the Jazz Orchestra Club that Diane Rosenthal had started at Maryville High School. Taiwanese business groups signed a new two-year agreement this week that increases the amount of corn and soybeans that Taiwan companies will be able to buy from Indiana farmers. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, the new agreement comes at a time when many Hoosier farmers are struggling, in part because of the ongoing trade war with China.
Indiana exports about $1.5 billion worth of soybeans and $600 million worth of corn around the world every year. This new purchase agreement between agricultural groups in Indiana and Taiwan builds on their trade relationship and increases sales from Indiana, according to officials at the ceremony. Indiana Soybean Alliance CEO Jane Stevens says the agreement comes at a time when many Hoosier soybean farmers have taken a financial hit due to a trade war between the U.S. and China.
For me, this just represents that even though the rest of the world, we are in a big trade fight with China, we do have still continued strong relationships with Taiwan.
The agreements with the two Taiwanese trade groups also include purchases of corn, soybeans, and other agricultural products from states including Mississippi, Illinois, and Nebraska. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we will talk with Post-Tribune reporter Grant Morgan about, among other things, the latest involving the late Dr. Klopfer, the investigation about him over in Illinois, and also an update on the major federal trial that is going to be getting underway next year with Samantha El-Hassani. We hope you'll join us for that conversation and more tomorrow on Regionally Speaking.